Off the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Monday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website as well, stevebick.com. Since I left you noon on Friday, it's been a rather frenetic and momentous and disorienting weekend plus over and above even, of course, the racing action. And there's so much to absorb, and the news actually continues this morning at a head-spinning rate, most notably in the last half hour or so. Word coming that Classic winner, Authentic, is being retired and has been retired. And it's, I suppose, nice to go out on top. That certainly the case in his particular scenario. At the same time, you hate, as always, this conversation, you know, to have those that are established, you know, with any kind of heroics, and certainly Derby Classic winner goes a long way. But you can see what is happening with Spendthrift. I reached out to Ned Toffee, and clearly it's been a busy morning already. Last night we have to fold in, because what went on at the Fasig Night of Stars was pretty remarkable as well. And from that side of the aisle, well, Authentic stepping away and retiring. Vekoma's retirement was announced yesterday. The flip side is that a couple of prominent mares that we kind of thought were headed off to broodmare careers were sold last night and are coming back for another year of racing. The Monomoy girl news and Got Stormy news kind of, I think was surprising. I hadn't really been thinking about that part of the weekend's aftermath, but Monomoy girl, $9.5 million after her exciting distaff win, culminating essentially a plan and, you know, the executing of a return after missing a year, and, you know, being really beautifully handled into Saturday to win the distaff, and of course part of a monstrous weekend for the Brad Cox barn. Four wins. And, you know, Monomoy certainly, I'm not going to say a universal choice as the only win candidate, because, you know, the Swiss Skydiver element, the big matchup never really materialized. We have to talk, of course, about the racetrack, which is going to be a, you know, has been a source of nonstop discussion since Friday. We didn't even need Saturday's results and some of the things that, you know, became increasingly obvious as one track record after another was established. And we'll discuss that, actually. The Andy Beyer, who always joins us, you know, after, you know, the big the big weekends like this, and in particular when there's controversy or confusion or the usual teeth gnashing and hand wringing over figs. But Andy's going to visit with us and address a handful of things, most notably the people confused seemingly about why Whitmore's figure would be higher than Nashville's from Saturday. Ron Moquette will join us this hour. One of the best stories, of course, of the weekend. Moquette and Whitmore. Unbelievable. Really unbelievable. Advanced age, and you know, you're thinking track is going to be against them by the time the race rolls around. And some interesting, I discussed yesterday with Seth. I did Seth's show as I was driving back. Actually made it all the way to Erie Saturday night, so it wasn't as arduous a Sunday drive. But I was home by noon, actually. I got up at 5 a.m. and hightailed it. But I was on with Seth at Capital OTB. And when you went back and looked particularly at that sprint, from a class standpoint, he really kind of outclassed that, or at least classed up to that field. And when you went back and you looked at, you know, the top efforts, he made plenty of sense. There's so much to absorb out of this that we'll kind of just take it as the topics come up. To kick back to Brad Cox for a second, of course, two wins Saturday, two wins Friday, and Nixko, however you want to call him, followed up his big performance to take the dirt mile. And then on Friday, the juvenile filly turf performance on Pearl. And essential quality was very good. The colt race, the Jackie's Warrior, I think we raised enough concerns about the vulnerability that it didn't make sense that he was going to be so short and was going to be so, you know, so sure to be dominant. There were plenty of signs, and I think raised plenty of red flags. But essential quality followed up, and a really good performance. Luis Saez with a breakthrough, his first Breeders' Cup win. The wins were spread around for the most part. I haven't talked about any of the turf races yet, and we'll talk to Butchie Reed later. Vequist win as well, staying on the main for a second on Friday, and what a great ride by Joel Rosario. Rosario, of course, was on Nixko, so he ends up with a pair of Breeders' Cup wins. Johnny, let's talk about for a second, getting his first classic. And I don't even know what to say about the way the pace and the confrontation in the classic. We talked so much after Derby and Preakness that this is a horse that, you know, wants to get the lead, needs the lead, relaxes on the lead. And the way we looked at this race, how many different times and ways that it just looked like, you know, nearly half of the field had potential to at least go forward and be involved. What was the plan with Tis the Law? The horse is firing off, you know, 59s and sub 59 works, and was so eager and you know, coming into the race, and then to not go forward aggressively with him, that doomed him. And that was as big of a question as anything. I mean, you kind of knew that Maximum Security was going to try to, you know, sit off the stablemate and make his run when he was going to make his run. But Authentic did exactly what he did in the Derby. He just got out there and was relaxed. Would have been nice if we'd had a working teletimer. I mean, that we'll get to that at some point. I'm sure, I don't know if Andy will discuss it when we talk to him, but I mean, just, it's remarkable that you know, the biggest, you know, the entry mate of biggest 10 furlong races of the year, Derby and Breeders' Cup Classic, and can't be timed properly. It's I don't even know what to say. I'll stay with Johnny for a second and Baffert. You know, after the draw, said how Baffert was more, had more concerns and was more irked by Gamine drawing inside for the Filly and Mare sprint because he really wanted her. He was eager and anxious for her to get a chance to redeem herself after, you know, everything that's gone strangely with her, and she did. She got a great ride by Johnny, and that scratch of In the Midst of Biz, we talked about this, you know, last week at the end, the fact that Johnny was going to have a little more room to operate with her and wasn't going to be obliged to fire out. She gained position. Johnny eased around and made a big difference. I mean, her three performances around one turn have been just, you know, what are you going to say? They've just been spectacular. The turf action, there's so many things happened that you just, you kind of blinked your eyes in disbelief. How about the ride by Tom Eaves on Glass Slippers, the first of the European visitors to win a turf sprint? And Eaves put a ride on Glass Slippers for Kevin Ryan and Mr. Holdcroft. He's a character. Oh, it's a live wire, that guy. But Glass Slippers, who had, we talked how much, you know, how she had kept such good company, Batash, and it took a brilliant ride for Eaves to, I mean, if you had the in-race running on the exchange market, what was she halfway, you know, mid-stretch to get through and you know, probably had, what, five or six? I still have to watch replays yet again. I have only seen the races maybe twice each, so I got plenty of race watching. And that race, this turf sprint, you're going to have to watch six or eight times. There was a million trips going on in there. There were bad starts. Front run the Fed had broken better. Who knows? And talked to Mike Trombetta after the race, and he realized that if Eaves doesn't get through, Wet Your Whistle wins this race. How about the Filly and Mare turf? Rushing Fall and Rushing Fall sold last night. We'll run down all those things. But Adaria and the ride that Pierre Boudot put on, in fact, Boudot with two wins, of course, because later the mile win, the pickup mount because of Soumillon, and poor Christophe Soumillon, you know, arguably could have won two races. We'll get to Tarnawa in a minute. But Adaria, and a great job by Hammer, and a great job by everybody, by the way, on the betting companion. 14 races, basically a couple of Kev Humphreys didn't really have specific dollar amounts, but essentially over $1,800 in suggested wagering ideas from the team. And I can't thank them enough. I've already gotten a handful of emails and tweets and whatever else of people that either hit multi-race wagers or did something else. But Hammer was brilliant with his focusing and tabbing Adaria. Rushing Fall, though, got to say, Rushing Fall ran her ass off. And I thought she was going to hold off Adaria, but could not. And that that hurt. I, you know, from a personal standpoint, the way my tickets were, I singled Rushing Fall and absolutely thought for me she was kind of the key to the day. That's sort of, you know, sort of had to kind of reboot at that point. And it's already pretty late in the day to be, you know, to be having to, you know, regroup. But one of just, you know, so many places. Tarnawa, will stay with the turf side. Tarnawa's win. Dermot Weld. Dermot Weld respected worldwide. And success in a Breeders' Cup had eluded him. So for him to get his Breeders' Cup win, and, you know, Colin Keane, who, you know, jumped in into the breach with the news of Soumillon having to bow out the COVID diagnosis. And there was a big rush of support for Keane, and, you know, the sighting of his success, you know, his Irish champion rider and no less of an authority than on Irish race doings than John Parada. John sent me a text. He said, Keane, he gave Keane a big thumbs up, and he wasn't worried, and needn't have been. She was terrific, just terrific. And the turf, you know, the turf finish, actually, I mean, very, very much kind of the kind of what you thought was going to transpire there. Let's be honest. Magical ran great. Channel Maker, and, you know, Bill Mott didn't win, but, you know, a lot of his horses ran well, and, you know, particularly Channel Maker. You know, Gary Barber, you know, got the win with Vequist. He, you know, he had many chances and you know, got one win and a couple of other, you know, nice efforts. That gets us to the mile. And, you know, we stressed in the conversation, particularly with Nick Luck, the difficulties that Aidan O'Brien has encountered over the last couple of months. You know, the mishap confusing horses and the feed, the tainted feed story, and, you know, the two tragedies in Australia as recently as Tuesday in the Melbourne Cup. And all that he does is send out the top three finishers in the mile with the 70-1 shot winning, having drawn in. It about as crazy a result as you could have imagined. Not that Aidan O'Brien, you know, was going to win that, okay. that he was going to win with a horse that, you know, had this incredibly obscure set of PPs coming in. It's the craziest thing ever. I will say this. I was standing on the rail, and when the horses were coming up the stretch to move over to the turf course, they hadn't opened the gate fully. And the first horse, actually, that came to cross over was Order of Australia. And there were two things this weekend that really I violated a rule that I pound out regularly, which is, you know, reevaluating races after scratches. And of course, on Friday, it included George Weaver drawing into the Bryan Station with Ever Dangerous and winning at 70-1. You know, a horse that I didn't even realize. And of course, I'm on the air Friday, and it's a little harder on Friday with the, you know, that Friday, I didn't feel as stupid. Although, going back to look at that Ever Dangerous, that horse was far from impossible, but not even far from impossible, was competitive. This horse, I didn't even look at, honestly. I, you know, when the, you know, knowing that One Master had come out you know, you just glance at these PPs. I mean, the horse was beaten 47 lengths in a group three at the Curragh. And, you know, I had one earlier. Andy Serling had a funny comment. He said, who knew that the key prep for the mile was going to be the Sycamore Lodge Equine Hospital Stakes? Unbelievable. Order of Australia, Circus Maximus, Lope E. Fernandez, 1-2-3 for Aidan O'Brien in the mile. So there's a quick overview, and we'll obviously come back and we'll click off everything over the next several days. But the first order of business very frequently when it comes to reviewing Breeders' Cup is visits with Andy Beyer. And in particular, there's a topic that had everybody flummoxed pretty quickly Saturday night and into Sunday as people started to absorb the results and go through the figs and figure out what happened. And the way the racetrack was playing only added to the mystery. Nashville's performance, of course, had everybody excited right off the start of the morning. And note that it was the morning. It was 10:30 in the morning. We don't run a lot of races at 10:30 in the morning in this country. And I think that figures in. Andy Beyer, good morning.
Steve, good morning. It was certainly an eventful weekend.
Yes, and of course you're down in D.C. and it was eventful everywhere. Yeah. Andy, before I do anything else, before we start diving into Nashville and Whitmore and then other topics, you had a spectacular handicapping weekend. Congratulations.
Well, I wish it had shown up in my bankroll, but there was one race on Friday that I cared about incredibly much beyond betting, and that was the Princess Noor race and the Juvenile Fillies, which we can talk about at some point this morning.
Start
with yesterday's classic and how fast they ran, that might be a good place.
Well, all right, and then we'll visit the Whitmore, the 2 6 furlong races and how people need to view it and understand it. And I should have sent it to you. It just occurred to me, but I posted last night and I'll retweet it now. I took the post race charting, Andy, now in the new formulator, the opportunity to hit buyer figures and get the chart and the sequential performances. And so it helps people see the way they're striated, the way the race scores out. So I'm going to send that again. But let's talk about the timing and the authentic performance. And I said minutes ago, it's a little bit disheartening that, for arguably the most important or second most important 10 furlong race of the year, we can't time it properly.
Right. If you were watching the TV monitor, the TV screen flashed a quarter mile time of 17 seconds and something, and then there was no more time taken. I have a feeling, and this is just a guess, that was the time for the first 3/16 of a mile, and there was something erroneous in the setup of the timing system. I mean, this was only the third mile and a quarter race run at Keeneland since 2015, so it's conceivable there was just some kind of a mechanical screw up. Whatever the reason, there was no final time taken. And then, not too long after the race, Keeneland released a final time of 159.19. The chart said it was based on a hand time of the video. My guess is that, people were scrambling around at Keeneland, and somebody said, "Hey, Joe, grab your stopwatch and time the race." Now we do a lot of video timing. When we have questionable races or questionable times, and we've got as sophisticated a system as possibly have. I mean, it's high-end video editing software. And I asked one of our aces, Bob Weir, to time the race. And he got back to me and said, "I can't do it with any confidence, because when you're looking down up the stretch to try to see where horses start the race going past the pole, it's just hard to do it visually." And plus there was kind of almost no historical data to base timing on, and judging the typical position of the gate. The 159.19 is wrong. I can say that with great confidence. I really think it would behoove Keeneland to revisit this. To have a mistake like this in the most important race of the year, and to credit a horse with a track record, breaking American Pharoah's mark when he didn't do it, is just disgraceful. Now, what should they do? Well, Keeneland uses the Tracker system for its video display on the TV feed. Trackers times all the races, and you can find the Trackers times on their website, and they were their timing is always a little different from a beam system, but most of the race, their times were within like a tenth of a second of the official times in most cases, and their time for the classic was 159.82. That's what we finally wound up using, and it made sense. I think as long as Keeneland has got that Trackers data, they should look at that and just go with it rather than a "Hey Joe, time this race with your stopwatch." I'm kind of confident in this, because when we have a questionable race, we do what you were just alluding to about looking at what horses have run previous to today's race, on the on the Formulator website, and like the figure we gave to the classic of 111, it just makes sense. I mean, Authentic clearly, I think, ran the race of his life and improved to run that. Improbable, who ran second, gets a figure of 108, duplicating his last start at Santa Anita. Third place, Global Campaign, gets a 106. He was a late blooming horse who'd run 104 in his previous race. Tis the Law gets a 103, duplicating his Kentucky Derby. So the numbers just all make sense for these horses, and if you took the time that Keeneland put out, everybody would be like 6 points higher, and you'd say, "Gee, everyone in the field improved suddenly." That doesn't usually happen. So I'm confident in the figure of 111, and I just hope that that Keeneland will try to address the data for this race.
Well, they've got 2 years that they can that can work on straightening this out with the 10 furlong configuration. You know, from a performance standpoint, Andy, aside from the figure, I know that I'm just looking down. You picked Tom's the Tot as I did, and you had Improbable, Tis the Law, and Authentic as your top four. How surprised were you that after the expectation that there was going to be Authentic pace, that everybody essentially took back to an extent and let this horse, who showed in the Derby what he would do if left to his own devices, I was stunned that he was allowed to lope along out there.
Of course, we're not sure how fast he was running.
That's true. We don't know.
I think it was about a 47.5. So that, you know, that it's not like he was crawling. I don't know. I would say, you know, when people see a super fast track like this, you know, they make kind of a leap of judgment. I mean, you were talking about how fast how the track was playing. I don't think the track was playing any way. It was just fast. But you know, I don't think there was a bias or anything carrying Authentic. I mean, plenty of horses, you know, came from off the pace. I thought the races were basically honest, and you know, Authentic. He's a very good horse. He got loose. You know, you knew that Maximum Security was not going to go duel with him, and because of the common trainership. So I was impressed by his performance.
Absolutely, and I think from a frustration standpoint, it is the one I was disappointed in, because he was giving every indication that he came in early, was moving beautifully over that track, was working fast, had been eager every morning in a good way, and then wasn't allowed to utilize, you know, his strength, and you know, never really was in a position to contend.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, he ran that one big race of 109 that he, you know, and I think we all expected him to be firing that kind of shot for the rest of the season. And maybe he's not as good a horse as he looked that day. I don't know.
Let's focus on the 6 furlong element here, and the opener. Everybody was agog at the way in which Nashville won, and you know, here's a lightly raced horse that essentially was being preserved a little bit rather than contend in the sprint, where the barn actually was still going to have a major player in Yoppin. And Echo Town, but watching the way he won, and then watching the clock when Whitmore wins the sprint, there was going to be the immediate comparison. And in fact, after Nashville won, Andy, the first thing people were saying is, "Well, let's see what happens in the sprint." Explain the way you approach this, and how you think the track may have changed at all.
First, I'll say this. I feel I am absolutely right about what I'm going to tell you. I have in recent years learned that one of the factors that really confuses speed figures and makes them sometimes somehow hard to understand is the application of water to the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
And and we've seen situations in other tracks where you get races just come super fast out of the blue, and you say, "What the heck happened?" And there's a new breed of track superintendents that are much more kind of hands-on in terms of maintaining the track during the races, and sometimes just, you know, it's not it's nothing nefarious, but they'll change the way the track is maintained in mid course. Now, I was told by an absolutely unimpeachable observer that the water trucks went around the track two or three times before the first race, and accounted for that incredible time of 107.89. The track immediately slowed down for the next race to kind of where it had been, you know, the day before, even slower than that. And I guess I would read the track superintendent's mind and think he looked at that 107 and change and said, I overdid it a little. We got to back off. So it was different tracks. We assigned the first race an arbitrary figure of 102. Maybe we're a little off, but this wasn't a monster race. You look, say, at the second place horse in that field, Wild West. He gets a figure of 94 running second to Nashville. His previous four dirt races were 87, 85, 73, 77. I mean, how much higher can he be? So I think the 102, defines Nashville, and that super fast time was just a function of how fast the track was.
And it makes plenty of sense. And you know, there's also an element of this that I brought up as people were watching on Friday, and you know, the concerns or the observation about how fast the track appeared to be. What I noticed was a lot of kickback, and there was a video. I'm trying to think of which race. It might have been the Dirt Mile. I've got to find it, where they the camera angle. And of course, you're not watching video really on track when you're there. But I saw it later, and the. You know, the clouds of dirt that were being generated, that's also a factor in inhibiting the horses that typically want to rally, because next thing you know they start turning their head and they lose ground to the leaders, so they've got more work to do when they try to rally. So the kickback I think was part of this discussion.
Well, could be, but horses were rallying.
There were some. Yep.
So I'm not, as I say, I'm not sure that I don't buy the argument that, that there was some kind of a bias. Although, I mean, if there's a lot of kickback, I'm sure individual horses can be affected.
Well, Whitmore, basically, let's see, yeah, it was from early on at the quarter was sitting 10th, and right. It made a steady progress and then burst to the lead mid-stretch. And we're going to talk, actually. Ron Moquette is going to follow you, Andy.
Okay.
It was one of the best stories of the weekend. Really,
yeah, I was doing a webinar on the race, and I had picked for Inspire, but I said, I kind of look at Whitmore. This horse has run lots of good races, and Ron Moquette is a sharp guy, and every time I'm looking the other way, he just wins in my face. So, but regarding the time there, the Whitmore followed a turf race. I don't know what the track maintenance, was like, but I think the track had, the track just had to be slower than it was for much of the rest of the card, because if you took that time at face value, you would say every horse in the field went off form, Well, that doesn't happen. I mean, we assigned Whitmore a figure of 104, which is like his career best. He had a run well. I mean, he won in a field of 14 by daylight. But like when you look at the figures that all the other horses got by running behind Whitmore, they were in their numbers. I mean, if you subtract 10 points from that, I mean, the results would be ridiculous. So, you know, whatever happened, I would say the 104 really represents what Whitmore is capable of and what the rest of the field did. I wish we could, you know, in cases like this, I apologize that, we can't be more precise, but the alternative is putting down a figure that just makes no sense for any of the horses.
Now, for those that want to see a visual representation, a charting, I put it out last night. I just sent it again. I also just put up the classics charting, and it basically, so that you can read it more easily, I screen capture races six back in both cases, and it really should help people understand, and you know the spread at the various distances for beaten lengths, and that's how the beaten lengths adjustment charting, and you'll see it. This was a great innovation, Andy. What they've done on Formulator,
it's been around for quite a while.
Well, I mean, it automatically, it's right there, for ease of the visualization, to have that as part of the menu, right on the PPs and, each day. But believe me, it's made it so much easier to, to navigate in that regard.
Right.
So
oh.
I invite
you. Okay, well, you've restrained me long enough. I have to talk about Princess Tour.
Yes. All right, here it is. Here's what you've been waiting for.
I became sort of obsessed by this horse in mid-September on the day, when I was watching TVG, and she was running in the Chandelier at Santa Anita, and the commentators were saying, this is just a classic example of why you just should take the buyer speed figures with a grain of salt, because Princess Noor had run figures, had trounced two fields and had run figures of 76 and 79, and the commentators were saying, everybody knows that this is a great horse. One of them compared her to Ruffian. Another said, you can just tell by looking at her stride that she is an incredible talent. Well, one of our watchwords is figs don't lie. And she had, in that race at Santa Anita, she ran another, she won by eight lengths. She got a figure of 78. And the figures were unequivocal. There was no ambiguity. The track wasn't changing. They were all slow races. And, coming into the race, I saw, on some websites, there was just a huge amount of discussion of this race, and can the numbers be right? Do you go with your eye or do you go with the numbers? And they couldn't shut me up when I was on webinars talking about how Princess Noor is just, this is why we make speed figures, so that we can look past all the hype and just look at the truth of the time of the race. And of course the result confirmed that that she is not a superstar. I mean, she actually improved enough to run an 85 and finish fifth with no excuses in the field of seven on Friday. But you know, my old friend Steve Christ, who was responsible for getting the Buyer Speed figures into print many years ago, emailed me right away and said, this is the greatest moment in the history of the Buyer Speed figures. And then he quoted a line from Picking Winners: "Speed figures are the way, the truth, and the light." So
And I just put up so that people can again appreciate this. And this is not to say that Princess Noor didn't run well. She ran a career best. She got an 85 Saturday, and she was involved. Vequist got a wonderful ride from Rosario, a daring ride and a confident ride up inside. But you know, she had come into it, her pattern coming in a 72, an 83, then a 91. She gets a 93. Day out of the office, fired and ran her race. Girl Daddy improved. She ran very well for Dale. And Simply Ravishing ran essentially. She essentially paired up.
The time of the Frisette, you know, was very fast. I mean, it was the same day as the Champagne. It was just a little bit slower than a really well-regarded group of male 2-year-olds. So I mean, the numbers were really solid on the top two finishers.
The juvenile group, actually, we should mention too, because the boys' race came back fast too. 95 for Essential Quality, and I just heard from Brad Cox. He's going to join us tomorrow. He's doing stuff at the sale at Keeneland today, so he's begging off for tomorrow. Andy, I brought this up to people last week as we were doing the handicapping portion leading in, and each year in the DRF Players Guide, there is the list of winning figs from all the Breeders' Cups. And it's one of the most important documents and documentations of the Breeders' Cup, because number one, you can see how, you know, figs have changed over 35 years. For the ones, I think they started after four seasons, right? Yeah, 88 is the first numbers. But there's also the par element. And I invited people last week to look at the buyer pars for each division and get a feel for who seemed capable of running the kind of fig that wins these races.
Yeah, the pars have become a little hard to judge because in certain classes, the horses are just not running as well. I mean, in part because, you know, young horses in the U.S. now just don't start their careers as early or run right. Run as frequently. And we've certainly seen this the effect of this light training in the Triple Crown races. I mean, horses go into the Kentucky Derby with four career starts. There's no way they're going to run figures that horses did in the 90s. They just don't have enough bottom, and that's certainly going to apply to the 2-year-old races in the Breeders' Cup as well. It's just a different world. The thing that I don't understand is the decline of American sprinters. The Breeders' Cup sprint in recent years has just mostly been run in figures of in the low hundreds, and I don't get that, but we really, for the most part, we haven't We haven't had many blockbuster sprint performances. Although Gamin, I thought was one of the brilliant stars of the weekend. I love her, and I hope she'll just go on to greater glory. Boy, she is fast.
Well, around the one turn, she's going to be the female sprint champion, and these three races that she ran. Are as good as you'll ever see, I think, essentially, from a three-year-old filly going six and a half, seven furlongs.
I had thought she might be another Rachel Alexandra, and I think her at least at shorter distances, she is comparable, and I can't give any horse a much higher plaudit than that. I guess that she just doesn't have the staying power that Rachel did, but wow, she is a terrific talent.
Any other observations, Andy, from the weekend?
I did learn one thing. It is now official. I have no idea how to handicap European grass horses, and I should just stop trying. I would say that Order of Australia ranks right up there with Mind That Bird as one of the most incomprehensible results I've ever seen. Although I emailed a friend of mine in Europe who's pretty plugged in, and he pointed out that the horse came out of a key race at Leopardstown six races back, so that could have been the tip off to the 73-1.
I mentioned this earlier. I literally, first time I laid eyes on him was when he walked by to cross over onto the grass course. And I looked at him. I said, geez, he's a good looking horse. And then the next time he was walking into the winner's circle, and I was astounded. I mean, that O'Brien, considering everything that has gone wrong for O'Brien these last 6 weeks, this was the most outlandish result yet. So crazy. Andy, I can't thank you enough. As always, this is always edifying.
I always love thrashing these races around, and I'm glad to have the chance to explain some of the the figures that people might question. I mean, this is sometimes not as exact a science as we would like.
Andy Beyer, everybody, the one and only, always tremendous. We're going to stay right here, and we talked just obviously as part of the Nashville performance and then the equivalent six furlong Breeders' Cup sprint. We're just, thrilled, and like so many people around the sport that felt the sprint and Whitmore's win in it was the highlight of the weekend. And I know that, for having been there and just, seeing everything that was written later on Saturday night and into yesterday, and one of the most popular horsemen in the sport, Ron Moquette, congratulations.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This seemed, as the day was wearing on, it seemed like a task that was reasonable, and he was certainly coming back for another try at this. It seemed like he was going to be up against it. The track was fast, and Andy Beyer just kind of added to this discussion by saying it was fast, it wasn't necessarily biased. Talk about your thoughts as the day was going, and whether you thought that it was going to affect you negatively.
Well, we get the timeline of how everything unfolds. The first race goes really fast, that's a fast horse, but I also know from working horses in the morning at Keeneland and at Churchill and other places that if you work them before the break, it's a lot faster than it is working after the break, sometimes two or three, you know, 2 seconds with the same amount of effort. But so I was like letting it fold out, like, okay, where did the horse that finished second start from, and who made up any ground? And as it was coming out, the first had me scared to death. The second race, you know, we had track records. And then I was thinking, well, these are the world's fastest horses running. And we do have, you know, a turf race coming in between where they pack the track. And I was thinking, man, I hope that we just want a fair shake. That's all we want. We ran on speed bias tracks because we run on big days. And it seems like that's the popular thing is on big days, it seems that the Bob Baffert horses and the horses that break on the front end always have an advantage. And, you know, we were worried that it was going to turn into that. But as the day come on, we just decided we're going to shoot our shot. It doesn't matter. And we're out there running against horses. And from that point on, get out of our mind and just go do our job.
Talk about Arad, and I was actually fortunate later, you know, about an hour and a half maybe after the sprint, Ricardo Santana was done for the day, and I want people to hear about this and for you to explain, you know, the exchange and what you know, what that was about in terms of Santana helping Arad Ortiz understand an approach to Whitmore.
Well, I think it starts off with understanding there's nobody in the world as competitive as Ricardo Santana. And, I mean, whenever we run against each other, you know, I've actually had people go, man, he looks at you like he wants to kill you. I mean, he does. He wants to win the race. But at the same time, he understands that Whitmore is quirky and can be a little bit overwhelming for people. And these riders, they work together to never give any information that's gonna put them at a disadvantage, but at the same time, let them know if there's something about a horse that they should know, just like I would if I sent a horse to Steve Asmussen or Cox tomorrow and say, hey, this horse kicks or this horse does this. Well, they try to help each other to maintain, you know, a safe relationship with the horse and to come, you know, come full forward with a good effort. And he was willing to talk to Irad and remind him of a few of Whitmore's idiosyncrasies. You know, they have a trust with each other that is more than the trust he would have with me. There's a kinship there from being in the room and doing the same thing, that when I say it, sometimes they look at me like I've got two heads, where if another rider, a fellow rider, says the same thing, they listen to it. So it was very, very, very nice of him to do that. And everything worked out great.
Yeah. Cause I heard you say to him, if I tell him it, he just, you know, he just hears it. You telling him that he takes it to heart. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, for, you know, there's both of those young men learned English very well. They both understand, you know, when I tell somebody to do something, I don't ride these horses in races. So when I tell them, I don't necessarily have the same exact thing of way of communicating with them, and it has nothing to do with the English language as much as it does the way that they communicate with each other. You know, like, hey, when he goes into the turn, he's going to drift in or out depending on if there's a horse there, and it's not that he's trying to get off of anything or whatever. He just wants to go screw with that horse, and if you fight him with it, he'll do it worse. So just kind of coaxing through there, and you get around to the straightaway, and if you hold him, he's going to come flying down the stretch, and it worked out perfect.
Talk about leading into this and, you know, the season itself. And of course, there's the interruption between April and July, but, you know, the last few years, there's been the you know, the year-end goal. He certainly, you know, has run well in this event. He's also run into, you know, monsters. You only have to go back to last year in Mattoli to appreciate, you know, there he rallies and you know, ran essentially his career best. We just had Andy Beyer. Last year he ran the best figure of his career, 105, and, you know, still fell three lengths short. You know, talk about the plan for this year and trying to get him to be able to peak on Saturday.
Well, we always plan for two races. It's the with Whitmore. It's the Count Fleet and the Breeders' Cup Sprint, and then we try to go through there and you know, with geographical situations and shipping and timing, we try to figure out now where else would we like to run. And after, during the time that COVID broke and, you know, we were left with a lot of races canceling. The Churchill Downs Handicap would have been our next spot. And that race was no more. There was no grade one Churchill Downs Handicap run this year. And so now we're going, okay, what do we do now? Where do we go? And we're just shuffling around. And for me, you know, I train horses, and I try to get the most out of them, and I do that by scheduling and working towards a schedule, and then we have to, you know, you get punched in the face, and you have to back up and try to figure out how do we go from here, and that's what we did, and, you know, it worked out great. Last year, my plans would have been great had it not been for a horse called Mattoli. I mean, we tried, you know, it worked out very well, except for him being there. And, you know, one of the things I was going to say, I respect the tire out of Mr. Beyer, but I did not agree with the statement about the where are the sprinters. I mean, I'm a big fan of the game, too. And I was sitting there going, really, maybe he didn't see a horse called Mattoli or Run Happy or you know, I mean, I don't know which ones he's missing, but there's been some pretty nice sprinters out there.
Well, and the winner, and it's on that topic. I mean, I can run down here. I'll run down the numbers the last few years. Mattoli last year, a 112. Roy H. Had both years, a 111. Drafong, a 103. Run Happy was 108 on the track on Keeneland. Work All Week, 105, at Santa Anita in 14. How about Secret Circle, just a 98. Triniberg, a 108. Ambazombie, 107. Big Drama, 108. Dancing in Silks, 106. So, you know, there's like a range, basically, from, you know, from about Whitmore to, you know, about 103.4 to about 112. It is what it is. You go further back. Thor's Echo, a 116. That's a big number. Cajun Beat from Argolis. That was a speed bias racetrack, though, that day at Gulfstream. 120. A 119 for Squirtle Squirt, Bobby Frankel's first Breeders' Cup
win. Let me inject a little bit of something.
Yeah.
I agree 100% with figures. I use them all the time. But at the same time, if you're telling me that not disrespecting Mr. Margolis at what he did, because he had that horse ready to run, he run his eyeballs out, and it was great, but you're telling me that Cajun Beat, based on the numbers, was better, had a better performance than Mattoli or than Run Happy.
Right.
And that's where you lose me. I'm sorry.
I get it.
The numbers are supposed to be a reflection of what would happen if we were to put these horses in the gates together. You put Cajun Beat in the gates with Run Happy and Work All Week and Roy H. and Mattoli, and Cajun Beat is going to be hard-pressed to beat one. And I don't care about the number from that point. At the end of the day, we run against horses. And I use numbers, but they're just a tool. And I respect it when it works. And I always use it in my favor. If I'm trying to buy a horse and the number is a little low, I throw it at him and say, hey, he only run this. And I may pick up the phone and call my owner and say, hey, you know, that horse ran a big number. You know, I mean, we use them, but it's Not at the end of the day, it's horse racing, and it's what happens when people put two horses in the gates and they line up and run. But I love that because I'm dealing with the younger generation. It's not even buyers as much now. We're doing the Thoroughgraph and we're doing the Ragusons, and I'll tell them, guys, you know, there's been a lot of trips to the track and a lot of things that happened since they ran that number. We can't just say because it was the best number that they're going to win.
That's right.
You know,
That's right.
You can add a horse to that race. One horse. I mean, I was devastated that Nashville wasn't in our race originally because I needed speed in the race.
Right.
And now that's not saying that we're going to beat Nashville. I'm not saying that. Who knows? But I figured that Whitmore had a better shot to win had there been a lot of speed in the race and then going. As is with his history, if they go fast early, we have a better shot to win late. So I didn't want what we had happen in the Vanderbilt. So the introduction or the detraction of one horse or another to a system can change up a number completely.
The race dynamic essentially changes. Look at what happened in the Philly and Mare Turf, where you had Cayenne Pepper go off to that crazy.
Yes.
And it changed the whole dynamic of that race.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of that stuff has been, you know, we used to have the sprinters like Trenneberg and Gilbert Time and stuff going into the Kentucky Derby.
Right.
And then it would set up for a closer. And now that the Churchill has done the new point system and stuff, the way you're not allowed to get in, basically, if you're a sprinter. It's kind of made to where you it's the grinders. You know, it's changed the dynamic of the Derby completely.
Yeah.
And yeah. So they figured out that pace makes race. So I'm for using everything, every kind of tool there is. But at the same time, I'm not ready to say that any tool is more prominent to determining the outcome of a race than what you're looking at in the stall.
Couple of things to flesh out as part of this. You know, 7-year-old, fourth try, the horse, of course, that is most similar to him in Breeders' Cup sprint history, Kona Gold. And, you know, we go back to the Triple Crown season run, and we talked during that when he was emerging. And, you know, then it kind of became dedicated to one turning and, you know, races of six, six and a half, and seven. The rest of the way, career start 38, 15th win. He's now two wins, 2 seconds, and five starts at Keeneland. You know, give us a little bit of the career retrospective. And you know, we've talked so many times over the years after his wins and near misses, and you know how special he is. But explain, when you have a horse this good, this long, you know, what it's like every morning coming to the barn.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, you're always looking for a horse that can show what your barn can do. You're, you know, horsemen, we are only as good as what we have. And, you know, that's just how it is. And when we have a horse like Whitmore that wants to do what we want him to do and that is good enough to do it if we do our job, it means everything to us. And it gives us an opportunity to, for like me, reaching a dream of winning the Breeders' Cup Sprint. But it gives us an opportunity to showcase our ability of what we can do with a good horse. And it's every morning. It's a blessing to walk in there and to see a horse that wants to do so badly what we want to do. And we're so fortunate. And, you know, it's not just me. It's, you know, I'm so thankful for Saul and Bob LaPenta and even go far back to thankful for Nick Zito for introducing me to Bob LaPenta. And, you know, I mean, there's so many things that have to take place for a guy like me from the border of Arkansas and Oklahoma to get this kind of opportunity. You know, I'm emotional about it. You know, there's lots of stuff that doesn't pump me up or make me emotional. But if people knew the road that I had to take and the people like me have to take to get there, there's a reason why that I can't talk about it without, you know, wanting to explode into happy tears, is because it was not easy, and it took a lot of things and a lot of doors kicked in my face and a lot of, you know, sliding back down the hill and starting all over, and a lot of, you know, they changing up the recipe of what they want, the clients and stuff. And, you know, for Bob LaPenta to jump in and buy a horse with Harry Rosenbloom and give it to me, you know, and you know, and that started with Nick Zito. And, I mean, it goes all the way back to that. So it's like, it's huge. It's a unbelievable situation that I couldn't be more happy. And if we win, and hopefully we do a lot more of these kind of races, you know, this one will always be special because this is the one I wrote down. This is what I wanted. And that red son of a bitch took me there. And he is the coolest. I mean, he is just unbelievable horse, and it's his personality. It's everything. I mean, I wouldn't be good at writing a movie, but this one deserves it, in my opinion. And I know I'm close to the situation, so it may not be that much to everybody else. But if you saw, or you know, everything that I saw and went through this, you would understand why it means so much to people like me. It's unbelievable.
A couple of things, you know, I got to make it a little personal because, of course, the outpouring of support and, you know, the people that are sharing in, you know, your happiness and everybody around your barn and your family, too. Chance wrote on Saturday night, Ron. What
you mean? Oh, the post.
But yeah, the post on Twitter that was just, I mean, so perfectly, you know, toned about, you know, what, you know, what your you know, journey as a horseman has been like, and I also need to fold in, you know, the illness, because we're in the middle of a pandemic. I reference you frequently and John Nichols. You talk about pre-existing conditions under a situation that could kill either of you. And, you know, with that backdrop, I mean, there's so much about this that is just a triumph of epic proportion.
Well, first up, John Nichols is the man. He's the one that he and I are fellow lungers, is what we call each other. Where he helped me out with some. He tells me what he does, and it works. But it is important that we be careful. You know, it's not going to affect me the same way as it will everyone else. But at the same time, you know, like I went back to the other deal. This race meant everything to me, and you know, to the point that if everybody noticed, they did not see me running around the Breeders' Cup and taking the you know, the victory lap and whatever. I stayed at the barn. I stayed. You know, that's my normal deal. I love being in the big races. I don't like the big days. I don't like people in general. You know, I love people, but I don't like hanging out with people on race days. I'd rather be at the barn. And so I was very, with the help of my barn, cautious about where I went and who I talked to. And you know, we risked it and we said, we're going to go over there and we're going to be very careful and we're going to do this. And we thought we had a shot to win it. And there was no way I was going to miss it. No way. That was, I talked to my doctor and I talked to everybody, and there's no way that I wasn't going to be there to watch my horse run. And it worked out very well, thanks to Laura and Greta and everyone that helped me put all the proper procedures into place. It was and it was fun, and it was worth it, and I would do it again tomorrow.
The the performance, this performance, and you know, looking at how he has maintained literally since his 3-year-old year, and even, you know, even the good start to his career as a 2-year-old. What's been the secret of keeping him, you know, healthy and sound and happy? And certainly there, you know, there has got to have been some spots over the, you know, over the years between, you know, maybe, you know, between the end of campaigns and the start of the next year where, you know, there's concerns. You know, there's a horse that's 7 years old has got, you know, has got some arthritis, and, you know, there's always things that as a horse matures and ages that you deal with. Talk a little bit about, you know, what has made him so, you know, so sturdy.
I would say that the thing that we do with our horses that is a little different is that helps us in, with longevity, is that we go into it with the mindset of this is our big opportunity with this individual horse. So we do every precaution. And I've been fired before for not being aggressive enough. And I've been maybe overlooked because my win percentage wasn't as big as it should be, you know. But literally every step we do on the track and every decision we make is to try to put ourselves in the best position to make this horse last. Any horse. And you know, we from how we do individual shoeing to how we do individual feeding to, you know, it's not a program. Our program is not a program. It's specialty geared towards each individual. And, you know, you gotta start off with buying the right horse, obviously. But with Whitmore, we know where his weaknesses are, and we know where his strengths are, and we try to, you know, he's not going to go out there and do a big work on a bad track. I'm sorry, that's just not going to, that's not happening. We're not going to risk it, and we're going to do everything we can. If it means that I got to load him up in my truck and trailer and haul him to get shot over here because I like the way these shoes are, then I'm going to do it. That's the reason we keep our numbers down from what they could be, is so that I can do that sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm not saying that we don't need to grow a little or get a better group of horses or whatever, but we're not taking everybody that calls us for that special reason. I can cook very well for a set amount of people, but whenever I start inviting more people to the party, the food doesn't taste as good.
the portions, yeah, it gets out of whack.
Yeah, and I'm not knocking the guys that can. If you, all you have to do is ride, you know, have one conversation with Steve Asmussen or Brad Cox, especially Steve, because I know him very, very well. But you can tell he's a super intellectual, highly hyper-focused individual, and he can do that. It's obvious. You can see it. He manages his horses as well as an 8-horse outfit. And he does it with larger numbers. I just know that my situation is that I can do this really good for X amount of horses. And if we do it like this, we tend to get the results that we want.
Now, this is a result that has been sought for several years. And, you know, for those that don't know Ron's Breeders' Cup history, they may forget the Gentleman's Bet. When was Gentleman's Bet?
Gentleman's Bet was the year Secret Circle humiliated us in 13. So we that Bob Baffert, that guy's been a thorn in my side forever. It's like every time I look up, there's a Bob Baffert freight train running right in front of me. But no, I kid with him. But that was in 13, and we actually thought we had a shot to win it that year. With Gentleman's Bet, who's one of the prettiest horses I've ever trained, and he ran his eyeballs out. But, you know, that was one of the deals where we brought a horse to the party. He performed as good as he can, and it wasn't good enough that day. But and still, that's the fastest time I've ever had run, which was 107 and change. So And then we went back, and now this is our fourth time with Whit. And, you know, we were, everybody from Kentucky and other places are saying they want to win the Kentucky Derby. And if you look up at all the way back whenever they used to only talk about me fighting tough man fights, they would never talk about training. But whenever they used to do the interviews way back when, they'd say, tough man fighter. And then they would go, what do you want to win? And they're thinking I'm going to say the Kentucky Derby. No, I've said Breeders' Cup Sprint from day one. That's the race I wanted to win. Now I can move on to it from there. But that's the race I wanted to win more than any. So the fifth time's the charm.
Hey, I'm sure you know, think about what went on with Kona Gold too. I mean, and he did it kind of in the funny way, you know, the sequential, like fourth, third, second, and then won it. You know, you've got a second and a third here. He was eighth. If we go back to Roy H's win at Del Mar, I also want to bring up in this story as we, you know, kind of do a little bit of a career retrospective. Got to bring up Asher, who...
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, not only that, the owner. That's the owner that took me from Blue Ribbon Downs and said, you know, I've been all over the world. He said, you do as good a job as anyone. I want to give you the opportunity to go somewhere. And
wow.
That, the owner of Asher was, may he rest in peace, Mr. Jim Meyer. He was just crazy enough to, and he was an ex-boxer, and he knew me from that area too, and he was just crazy enough to give me a shot, and I'm so glad I was able to say his name for this, because Asher was his filly, and we went out there, and we picked a really nice year to go running the juvenile fillies, if you want to look at who was in that race. Let me see, Chalucky, Spain, Darling My Darling, Surfside, Scratch Pad. I mean, it was like the who's who. And we that was the first time we'd ever run. And I remember having to buy a tie there. And the gentleman where I bought it from, I guess he could tell by the way I looked that I wasn't going to be really good at tying it. He said, you want me to tie this and leave it untied for you? I said, boy, I really appreciate that. And so I could just slide it over my head and push it up my neck. But it was a really a culture deal for me to go to fly into Miami and run in that race, being a fan. Quick, funny story. I was there, and I was the groom and a hot walker and everything, right? So they kept coming by wanting to do the NBC sound bites, you know, and get some information from me. And I didn't want to do it. I was overwhelmed, and I was, you know, I did not want to talk to the media. And I was so young that whenever they come by there, the little finders for NBC would come by, and they would ask, is the trainer there? And I was, you know, looked like a groom. So I just looked at him and said, no, I think he's at the track. And so after about 3 days, they come by and they said, is your father the trainer? And I said, no, he's around here. And they said, well, would you please tell him that we need to get some information so we can have it for the show? And I said, yeah, he's around here somewhere. And, you know, I just kept on blowing him off. And then the day I was walking up with the horse going to the paddock with Asher, we left the holding barn and we're going up, and the little guy and gal that had been coming by trying to find Ron Moquette yelled, Moquette! And I turned around, and both of them flipped me off. Because I'd give them the runaround so I wouldn't have to do an interview the whole week. And they didn't know me, so it worked out perfect. But that's how far back it goes for me blending in, you know.
Well, I know that, and I just pulled up the chart, and it you talk about the chance to mention some names, and I'm just looking at this chart. Asher Broker Maiden in the Ellis Park Debutante. It was your first stake win, right?
Yes, yes.
And in fact, it was only like maybe your 13th, 14th career win.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at the horses that was in that race, I mean, that was some. I think the dam of a champion is in that race.
Finished second, trained by Greg Foley. Expanse was third, trained by Don Winfrey.
Expanse is the dam of Embellish the Lace, which is owned by one of my clients now, Mr. Lieblongs.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then how about Scooter? Scooter was fourth with Isabella Rose.
Which is also another great broodmare, isn't it? I mean, it's funny that race produced so many good breeding opportunities.
Well, and I'm just noticing that runner up, that Faithful Heart you mentioned, Swifty Farms from Indiana.
Yep, yeah, but that was a fun day to win that race. That's the last time I've had three races where I felt like I did the other day. Was that race, the Ellis Park Juvenile, because that was my first big one. And I know it sounds like 100,000, but it was 100,000 back then was huge.
Sure.
And then the Seat Gold, the Stephen Foster.
Right.
And then this race, those are all give me, I've had some other really grateful to have some really nice wins, but those are the ones that really like kicked me in the pants and like, you know, like, wow, I'm so happy about that.
Ron Roquette, the opportunity would be at hand then to, I assume, work toward a defense at Del Mar next year with Whitmore. And I'm going to guess that he'll be the only horse in the field that ran at Del Mar in the previous running of the sprint there.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. That's, you know, we've always said that Whitmore writes his own story and you know, as with all our horses, but if he's doing well, then we're going to let him do what he wants to do, and I would love to be back there, that's the thing is with a horse like him, if he's doing well, you always have a shot to win. It's not always a guarantee, but because there's always, you know, some other factors, but you always have a shot. You're always in there.
It was a story Saturday that a lot of people wanted that ending, and Ron, one of those results where even the people that didn't bet him, they were happy too, and everybody happy for you and the whole team. You mentioned Mr. LaPenta, and who else is involved these days?
Mr. LaPenta and Saul with Head of Plains,
right?
And the, you know, a guy that owned a small portion of it passed away right after the four go the next morning, and his family is gonna stay involved. But anyways, that was one of the things that I have is like I said, I'm very loyal. And this man had been with me for 21 years. I've got such a cool group of ownership, you know, with people that have been with me and stay with me. And I think that's because we work well together. And I mean, obviously we have had success, but we work together. And Mr. LaPenta and Saul and Joe Ford and William Sparks and Bowman and Elliot and, you know, all these guys, Lucella. I mean, these are all people that have stuck with me, and even, like I said, whenever I have the 9% win years, and when we have the years that we win our dream race, I mean, they stayed with me, and I'm so thankful for that.
Now, I'm going to guess that the King Cotton or the Hot Springs will be on the agenda to start the 8-year-old season.
Yeah, that's what we said. I told my barn the other day, all we do now is we take care of him and we figure out who Asmussen has. It's the next best one. So we wake up every year and have to figure out what you know, rocket ship do we have to beat from Asmussen. And we just take turns fighting and slugging it out, whether he beat us last year in the King Cotton with a horse, and then you know, he beat us. That's the only two defeats that Whitmore's had sprinting at Oaklawn has been at the hands of Steve and Mitoli, and share the upside. So we're going to point to the King Cotton right now and try to win it for the fifth year in a row if we can.
Well, there'll be some very, I'm sure there were some very happy folks in Hot Springs and throughout the region wherever Ron Moquette has gone. And Ron, really, when I said I wrote you this morning, I said I want to start the recapping with you because it was really the best moment of Saturday. We're going to have Butchie Reed, which in a lot of ways was a similar moment on Friday as well. We'll talk to Butchie later about Vequist's win, but just so pleased for you.
Well, thank you so much, and thank it, you know, also for making this a platform where trainers can be fans, and where it feels like I'm talking to just another fan instead of talking on an interview. So it's noticed, and we appreciate you.
Too kind. And I am, that's basically how the show is approached. That's what I am. I'm a fan and a horse player, and I'm in awe of everything that everybody does at every level in this game, because it's a lifestyle and a dedication, and it's not just, you know, it's not just a job for people. It's their entire lives, and the admiration is, you know, is widespread. Everybody that cares about the sport is rooting for people like you, and it's so good for the game when a Ron Moquette wins. You know, with Scooter retired and with Lynn gone, now maybe you get the new mantle, which is when Ron Moquette wins, everybody wins.
I'll take it. I'll wear that with a badge of honor.
I love it. Ron Moquette,
thank
everybody. Thanks, Ronnie. Ron could be followed at Moquette Racing or at Ron Moquette. He's got two accounts, and he's pretty much active with both of them. Rich Migliori is sort of standing by. He's once again, he's out in the countryside hiking. He forgot that he was supposed to be on at 10, and he says he's losing power. All right, the Rich. Oh, look at this. Wait, I'm going to send this picture out of holy cow, where he is. Oh my God, he's by these waterfalls, and it's absolutely gorgeous. All right. Rich Migliori joins us next. We got Butchie Reed to come as well. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's Live Foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com. From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.